Hey fam, Ty Bledsoe back at you, CEO of Undisputed LLC. Today's guest on the Undisputed Podcast, oh yes, is going to take us on a ride to the C-suite. Susan Winchester is going to be our guest, published author, consultant, keynote speaker, and former chief HR officer of two Fortune 500 companies is going to be joining us. Susan Winchester, welcome to the Undisputed Podcast with Ty Bledsoe.
It is so great to meet you, Ty. Thank you so much for inviting me to join you.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. As you climb the corporate ladder, what failures occurred and how did those failures or challenges propel your career growth?
Well, the list is long. I have an early memory of one of my very first jobs out of graduate school. And I had a really wonderful job, and I had the responsibility for a major project, and that major project went extremely well. And one day my boss called me into her office to give me an update on the project and told me that my team had been awarded the President's Award of Excellence for the work that we had done. So, of course, I was super excited. But then in the same breath, she said, "But I'm not giving you the award." And I was devastated, as you can imagine. I asked her why, and she basically dismissed me, sort of blew me off. And so I left feeling really confused. And I did something at the time that I would not do today, knowing what I know about how the corporate world works. But the next day, I went to her boss, and I asked him why I wasn't getting the award. The award was prestigious, but it also came with cash. And he didn't even know that my team had been awarded the award. He had no idea why I wasn't getting the award. But you can imagine that when my boss found out I went to her boss, the roof basically blew. I remember sitting in her chair after this all happened, and she basically blew into a rage. And I was extremely embarrassed. I felt like it was completely my fault. I deserved her anger, her yelling, her screaming. And I don't remember how I actually got up and left. I just remember hot tears streaming down my face and just feeling incredibly responsible for doing something wrong that led to me not getting the award, and then really making it that much worse when I went to her boss seeking guidance about what happened. And I will tell you that, you know, it felt like a huge failure. But part of the reason why, and this is what is so funny because I think about all these different moments in my career, part of the reason why it felt like such a failure was because I was taking all the responsibility for being bad. And what I didn't realize at the time, which I now realize thanks to the wonderful work with my co-author, Martha Finney, and the creation of the book, I now realize that what was happening to me in that moment with that very angry authority figure was triggering a lot of old emotion from my own childhood, from my own growing up. And while my dad did the best he could, my parents, of course, I think all of our parents and caretakers do the very best they can. They have their own set of issues that they're navigating from their own childhoods. And my dad had unpredictable anger, rage, which was very scary when I was little. He would come storming at me. And you know, what I know now because of all the work that Martha and I did for the book, the research around the impact of childhood dysfunctional experiences, childhood trauma, if you will, is that it definitely has an impact on our brain chemistry. And I believe strongly that when we're in situations in our workplaces, our reactions to other people are often fueled by the things that happened to us when we were little. And so unconsciously, I never realized I did this, but I believed that it was everybody else's job to determine my worth and value. And my job was to be as perfect and as people-pleasing as possible to earn their validation. And so part of why this felt like such a, you know, colossal mistake and failure in my early career was made worse by my past experiences when I was little. And basically, there are lots of moments throughout my career where I did things that if I could go back now and redo, I would. But I have a lot more clarity about how I respond to certain situations at work and have become much more capable of understanding and being aware of my own past beliefs and patterns and behaviors and interpretations of others to better able to self-regulate myself when situations are happening in today's world. So that's just one of many moments where I did something that I felt I should have done it differently and then felt terrible about it, beating myself up. And basically, I left that organization not long after that because I felt so humiliated and felt like it was so much my fault. Never even reflecting on the fact that her behavior was completely, it was way bigger than it was required for the situation. There was no explanation why she had decided that I shouldn't get the award. I still don't know why I didn't get the award. Actually, about 2 weeks later, her boss did. I did end up getting the award in the financial benefit, but it was a painful way to get that money. But it was a very valuable lesson and, you know, set me off on a journey of being very careful around authority figures who could decide your.
I'm interested, Susan, here. I want to double click on your experience. What advice or counsel would you give young professionals, particularly to women around the world that are entering the corporate arena, nonprofit arena, or advancing their career about trying not to feel the need to be perfect all the time and not trying to go out there and please folks, particularly those who have authority that drives their career?
Many of us, the research shows that nearly two-thirds of us grew up in a childhood where that we experience one of what are called the ACEs, the adverse childhood events. And the ACEs include things like sexual, physical, emotional abuse, emotional and physical neglect, addiction in the home, incarceration of a family member, mother treated badly. You know, so these are really big, what they call the big T traumas. These are really significant events. And when the CDC, in partnership with Kaiser Permanente, did a survey years ago, it was led by two doctors, Felipe and Anda. They basically asked 17,000 adults in the U.S., how many of these 10 ACEs did you experience when you were little? And they were shocked to find out that nearly two-thirds of the respondents indicated they experienced at least one of those 10 ACEs. 40% experienced two. And then I think it's 13 or 14% experienced five or more. And that's the group I fall into. And so I think the first thing to recognize is that if you grew up in a challenging childhood, regardless of what it was, even if you didn't experience an ACE, I've had lots of people tell me that they felt like they never measured up to their parents' expectations. You know, there are just so many things, but that what people are often unaware of is how much those past experiences really, and as I mentioned, this already influence every single thing that happens to us at work. And what I call it is, for me, this was 30 of my 36-year career, I was on what I call the unconscious wounded career path, completely oblivious to how much my own internal dialogue with myself was fueling my stress and anxiety. And I teach people how to step off that unconscious wounded career path where we're constantly feeling, you know, like we're always responding and reacting to other people when we feel like they're angry with us, disappointed in us, frustrated with us, whatever it might be. It fuels all that chemistry in our brain and how the brain stores memories, emotional memories, and our the amygdala, the survival mechanism of the brain that's fight, flight, or freeze. We go into these patterns every single day of going into work, feeling like we constantly have to prove ourselves, coming home at the end of the night and feeling like whatever we did wasn't enough, and then beating ourselves up. And if something happens at work, the workplace conflict, which Martha and I call a bumper car moment, when we've crashed into somebody and there's a very strong emotional response, we tend to ruminate about that. And we waste a lot of time and productivity around rethinking, replaying, retelling, you know, the events that occurred, and really creating an even bigger drama than what maybe actually happened. And the opportunity for everybody is that we can learn how to become aware of the past and its influence on us at work and start to step onto what I call the conscious healing career path, where we become aware of, awake to those past patterns, past beliefs we had. My biggest belief was I felt like I wasn't good enough. I've had other people tell me they felt like they couldn't do anything right or that they were stupid. You know, we all carry these, you know, beliefs with us, like, you know, they're the pilot of our lives, unaware, unconscious, unaware of how much they're influencing every single experience we have at work and how much it's driving us to seek that external validation from other people, which is part of the whole essence of what you described is people going in, feeling like they have to be perfect. If they're not perfect, they catastrophize what could go wrong if they do something imperfectly, or if someone rejects them or judges them or criticizes them. You know, it's like the workplace is ripe for opportunity for us to feel poorly about ourselves. But my view is that a lot of it is being fueled from our past dialogue that we are completely unaware of.
Wow. Where does your passion for tackling these complex business opportunities derive from?
I like solving problems. I've always been a problem solver. I think I enjoy that. I also just have been really blessed by God in my life, guiding me to different places that led me to the opportunities that I had. You know, I mean, silly things like I remember I had a double major in psychology and French, and I was a junior in college thinking, what do you do with a double major in psychology and French? And I stood at the board in the psychology department looking at all the graduate programs, and there was a program called a master's degree in industrial organizational psychology. And I loved that class. And so I ended up going to the program in Southern Illinois, and it was wonderful because it was a combination of, you know, looking at people through the lens of how they behave at work, but it was also heavy quantitative, which was a lot of statistics, quantitative statistics, which I also enjoyed. And I moved to Chicago, and I had worked for a guy in Michigan, John Harper, who owned a small consulting practice, who did outplacement for executives from a large corporation in town. And I learned all the techniques of how you go about finding and connecting with people to network to getting a great job. I just got blessed that I met this man who has this consulting firm. I ended up going back and working for him for 3 years. But I just feel like God has guided the entire path and has led me to these opportunities. It could almost feel sort of they just happened. I know that's not true. I know I've been guided. And I just kept moving into different places where I got bigger and bigger opportunities to solve problems and figure out a way to do it in a way that supports the people that are being affected by the problems of organizations, which of course is very complex and even more complex. Seems like it's getting greater and greater, greater and greater and more challenging every day.
Susan, what is emotional intelligence and how can we use emotional intelligence to accelerate the human experience?
Well, there's lots of different definitions of emotional intelligence. My view of emotional intelligence is that it's a person who has the capability to read the psychological geography in the room. In other words, they can feel and connect with what's going on for different individuals. And it's the ability to be empathetic. Obviously, I think that's a key component of it. Maybe a bit more on the feeling side. You know, the thinking feeling is a key. I think people need both, but sometimes people are extremely thinking, analytically oriented, and don't always get that piece around the ability to read the psychological geography of the room. I also think that emotional intelligence includes a leader being self-aware and recognizing their past impact. They recognize their pluses and minuses, and they take accountability for all of that. And then also, I think emotional intelligence is taking that self-awareness and being able to self-regulate when we get emotionally charged, or some people call it being hooked or triggered at work. It's wonderful, though. It's perfect timing, right? I'm reading a great book right now called The 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership. It's sitting here somewhere. I'm reading your book, and I'm reading that book. And in that book, the authors, I had to bring it out because I thought this is such a great definition. The authors of the book are Jim Detmer, Diane Chapman, and Kaylee Warner Klempf. And their definition, and they've got a great, they go into a lot of description of it, of emotional intelligence is somewhat different than sort of the traditional approach. Their definition says emotional intelligence embodies it through commitments to self-awareness, emotional processing, responsible communication, and conscious presence. They describe it as a lived moment-by-moment practice rather than a set of skills to master. And I love that. I thought that was, you know, it's really about leadership commitment to showing up in a certain way that they're taking their own responsibility for their emotions and they're managing that. And they do a beautiful job describing it in more detail in their book. So I thought that was, I was reading their book Sunday night after I'd finished some of your chapters and thought that was great.
Oh boy. Susan, what are some of the greatest challenges you face as a chief HR officer and how did you overcome them?
Well, it's funny. The first thought I had on the answer to your question was when I wasn't a chief HR officer, but it was one of the most challenging moments of my career. And that was back in the late 90s when the company I was working for had lost market share to its biggest competitor. And basically, there was an edict that was put out that we needed to cut 25% of every budget, which meant a lot of headcount reductions. And I was fortunate that I was able to keep my job, but I also had the duty to go out and meet with 30 to 50 people who had just been fired to tell them about their benefits programs. And you can imagine that those people weren't very happy about hearing from someone who was still employed by the company. And so it was a very obviously angry audience who were very combative and challenging. And I didn't really know what to do. I mean, I was very intimidated. I was very new in my career at this time. But I remember saying to the group, I want you to know that you probably don't want to be hearing from me right now, but I have important information that you need to have in order to understand what your benefits are. And if you keep disrupting me, I can't give you that important information. And I just remember feeling this strong need to give them what they needed. But boy, that was scary. I mean, that was an intimidating, scary moment. But I think it informed me for things in the future about how to do things if we have to go through some downsizing, which most companies have to go through at some point in their corporate life. But I would say the other challenge, of course, and I think this is obvious, was during the time of COVID. And, you know, being a CHRO during that time, I was very connected to many of my fellow CHROs as we tried to navigate the uncertainty and create as much clarity and support for our employee base as possible, because there was so much fear happening. And again, I think part of the reason why we navigated that so well was the network and connection that we had with other leaders going through similar things. But that was definitely a big challenge. And then the other challenge that stood out for me was actually during COVID, when I was working at Applied Materials, our customer demand was skyrocketing. So those were a couple challenges, the challenge of the COVID and how to manage that. And then, of course, the ramp with so many new people coming in and how do you bring them in and make them as successful and onboard it as quickly as possible.
Despite the competitive global hiring and retention environment, why are companies, large and small, moving away from high-touch, successful programs that are resonating with their employees?
Well, I was curious if you could say more about that, because that has not been my experience of companies moving away from high-touch programs. I think generally companies are always trying to find the most efficient and effective way to give people information they need to be successful. But, you know, Applied Materials was my most recent experience. I was with them for 5.5 years, and there were a lot of things that were happening that I would say were high-touch all around the world, you know, so We were connecting with our employees. The executive team were doing videos and you know, we were doing some very cool culture work so that people would recognize that our ability to be as connected as possible was going to enable us to create more value in the marketplace because of the strategy we had. So I have maybe been blessed that, you know, high touch companies are just always looking for ways to connect with their employees. I think companies do it in different ways depending on their resources and their capability. But I was curious if you had a specific example of something you've seen where programs are being scaled back.
Oh, boy. Ooh, look at Y'all, now you know here on the Undisputed Podcast, right, we have a featured guest posing a question on me, putting me on the hot seat. I have a couple in mind. I may talk about them offline, but I will say this. So now we're going to have the consultant hat on, right, Susan? For our chief HR officers, our senior leaders across business organizations, what would you recommend, without giving away the secret sauce, ways in which organizations of all sizes can really drive engagement and retention that still benefits and elevates talent performance? Because perhaps it may be, right, moving away from high touch may not be the best solution, particularly in this hyper-competitive environment, especially what's happening now in the economy, the global economy.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate that I had such an amazing career and I get to kind of play with some amazing clients. What I really focus on and what I think makes the biggest difference in companies, I've actually got kind of three pillars that I focus on in my consulting. One pillar is all around leadership capability. I call it leadership synchronicity, which is everything we've been talking about: leadership self-awareness, self-regulation, self-development. You know, it's executive coaching is a key component of the work that I do there. And I feel very strongly about that being a key foundation for every company, in that the leaders of the organization are the ones who really set the tone for the culture and how the company works related to engaging and retaining its people. And Sen Delaney, which is a wonderful culture company that's done a lot of work with many of the top Fortune 100 companies, have a concept they call shadow of the leader. And whatever the leader's shadow is that's being cast into his or her organization, people in that organization will emulate that behavior. You know, so I had a CEO years ago who would get into the office every morning at 4 a.m. He had no expectation that anybody else get in at 4 a.m., but he liked to get in and read all the global news about anything that might potentially affect our industry. But people thought they had to be in early. So they would literally, if you showed up in the parking lot at 6:30 or 7, it was full. And, you know, so it was a very interesting shadow of the leader. But if you have a leader that's incredibly anxious or worried all the time, that whole energy gets cast into that organization. If you have a leader like the one I was just talking about who would get in at 4 a.m., who stayed balanced and calm no matter what. If things were great, he was balanced and calm. If things were terrible, he was balanced and calm. He created this sense of calm and will handle anything throughout the entire organization. And so I feel like that leadership capability piece and supporting leaders to help them be even more impactful and effective in their organizations is critical to the health of the company and the people in it. The second pillar that I believe strongly in is a body of work around a model that I have called the suitability model. And I think a lot of organizations really struggle with how do you really match people into roles and make, you know, do as much as you can to make sure that they're successful. We have too many instances where we put people in roles and they fail. I mean, I had 10 bosses in one of my companies in 10 years. That's a bad track record. Companies are spending a lot of money on bets about who's going to be successful. I teach a model to organizations. I've taught it to universities. I've taught it to corporations. I've taught it to private companies that enables people to really understand what matters most when you're matching people to work. And it's good for any talent decision, whether it's because it's foundational to assessment. I think most of the competency models that are out there are confusing and vague and don't really help us enough. I think they actually create more problems than solutions. And with suitability as a foundation for all assessment, it's great for selection, development, coaching, performance management, succession planning. Basically, every single decision that leaders are making about people is enhanced dramatically by leveraging the suitability model. And then the third foundation of my work is all around my book, My Healing at Work System, which is all about how do you really elevate an organization's capability to create a workplace that acknowledges these unconscious patterns and behaviors for all of us, most of us anyway, and enables people to live as much as possible on that conscious healing career path, which enables higher retention, greater engagement, and higher performance ultimately for the company.
Boy. Let's talk tech. How is artificial intelligence changing the landscape, and what are the best solutions for professionals to?
Yeah, I love it.
You have my question.
A lot of people are thinking about this right now, so the topic is very relevant. So here's Susan Winchester's view of the world, and it's influenced by some super smart people, which I'll mention here in a minute. I think AI is amazing, and I am learning more and more about how it can make our lives easier, regardless of what job you're in. And I had the privilege a few years back to attend a Chief HR Officer event at Microsoft, thanks to Kathleen Hogan, the Chief HR Officer, who I think is just stepping into a different role. And anyway, they've got some changes happening. But it was an amazing experience because we had Satya on stage talking about AI and their development of Microsoft's Copilot. And then we had the lead innovator, his name was Jeff, and I can't remember his last name, but he was on stage to really highlight the possibilities and potential of how their Copilot or, whatever AI capability you're using enables a leader to be even more effective because it can do things in seconds that could take us hours and hours to do. And their whole point was AI will it hope, the hope is that it will eliminate the drudgery. It's so funny because one, it was literally, I was there on Monday, and on Sunday, the day before, I was spending hours trying to put together a PowerPoint presentation and had all this content from all my Microsoft Office, Word, PowerPoint, everything, the Teams sessions, whatever. And they were demonstrating how you could ask Copilot to basically say, look, I need a presentation on this. I need you to pull from these different pieces of my work and put together a presentation that's no more than 20 slides. And boom, I mean, it was like within seconds. And now, even in my own consulting practice, I'm leveraging AI to help me understand key themes and patterns coming up when I do diagnostic work for companies. I always go back and I refer to my notes because I think it's important, but I can do things so much more quickly. So I think it's an amazing instrument. And the other thing I was going to mention is that at Applied Materials, we had one of our engineering technology conferences, and on stage was Sam Altman, who is the CEO of OpenAI and very instrumental in the AI world. And it was really interesting to hear him talk about the impact of AI on the world. And he was very low-key about it and really was thinking of it more like when we first developed the internet. It like changed everything, but it enabled us to do things that we've never been able to do. And I believe fundamentally that's what AI will enable us to do, is to do things more effectively and efficiently, enabling us to do other things with our time. And really believing I, am very significantly impacted by time and how precious time is. I can do something in seconds with an AI that used to take me 4 hours. I love it. So that is my view of AI. I think it's going to be an amazing, it already is an amazing, almost like an assistant that we can give. Obviously, you have to be very specific about what you're asking it to do. My own personal coach, Celine DaCosta, she and I were just talking yesterday, and I loved her view of AI as like my personal assistant, that I can ask it to help me. I need to guide it, and then I need to review it and edit it, but it can be very useful. And so she treats her AI like it's an assistant to her.
Susan, across the world, billions of people are going to work feeling anxious, isolated, as if they're not good enough. There's a special group of people who are under a constant of feeling that they're just not meeting the bar, right? How is your book, Healing at Work, helping millions of people around the world face these challenges?
Well, thank you. I hope it reaches millions of people. That is my goal and mission. And the reason why, when people either hear me speak on stage, I do a lot of keynote speaking on it. My favorite keynote topic is called "When Your Past Gets in the Way of Your Future." Really unwinds everything we're talking about here. But basically, what you're describing is that, and I said this earlier, so many of us are showing up at work in a state of unconsciousness about how much our childhoods and our past affected how we think about other people and how we think about ourselves. And the stories we tell ourselves tend to be stories of spiraling into a lot of suffering emotion, painful emotion. I was listening to a podcast last week, a guy named Eric Balance, who had an amazing woman. I'm not going to remember her name, but she talked about there are two states in our life. There's suffering and not suffering. And I see so much suffering that people are creating unconsciously for their own selves. I did this for 30 years. I was in a spiral of a spiraling, and that unconscious wound occurs is like a spiral down into the pit of suffering and painful emotions. I did it every day. I'd go home, beat myself up, feel like I was doing a performance review of myself every day, and then use Chardonnay to help take the edge off of it because I did not know how to self-regulate. No, I know it's actually not funny. It's sad because so many overachieving perfectionists who are feeling like they are not enough. And this goes to the very top levels of companies, to boards, et cetera, to very senior people in the academia world as well. The imposter syndrome and the effect it has on ourselves because of the stories we tell ourselves unconsciously. That is the beauty of healing at work, is it helps people heal. That's very possible. We are capable through the science of neuroplasticity and positive psychology research. We can actually start to rewire those neural pathways as we learn more of stepping onto that conscious healing career path, where we become much more aware when I'm having an emotionally charged or triggered response to somebody at work. And so often we go into blame mode, you know, Ty, my boss, you know, he just doesn't understand, or, you know, whatever, people are judging one another all the time. When in fact, most of what's going on inside of us is a cocktail. This is straight from that, the 15 commitments of conscious leadership, a cocktail of adrenaline and cortisol cursing through our body because we're in fight, flight, or freeze mode. And so the opportunity to unwind that and become consciously aware of our past patterns, that's when we could start to practice new ways of responding when all that emotion's coming up for us, leading us into that state of suffering.
Boy. Okay. So look at, we almost made this a counseling session. I laugh because there's been, okay, so I'm going to be vulnerable here, fam. There's been years, many years throughout my life, my adulthood, that would be me outside of going home and drinking Chardonnay, just constantly racking myself, my brain about how can I improve self-improvement, meeting expectations either that I put on myself or that those around me and such forth. But goodness gracious, if I knew what I knew then, now, goodness gracious. So I'm laughing because it was describing myself looking in the mirror.
Yeah, it's actually shocking how many of us use unhealthy self-soothing habits. And it could be beating yourself up. It could be, for me, it was alcohol. For other people, it's shopping or social media or porn or whatever, to try to find that state of calm. You know, we're trying to manage it. Again, God intervened in my life almost 21 years ago, and thank God for that spiritual awakening. But this April 26th will be my 21 years of sobriety.
Wow. Congratulations.
I know. A lot of us are suffering and are actually unaware of how much that suffering is actually coming from our own selves.
Susan, I'm going to be impromptu with this question, but I'm just led to ask this question. How is your faith grounded you and really, really helped propel in all that you do as a leader at the individual level and also through personal growth?
I love that question. I think I am very guided by God, and it's because I ask God every day to guide me. And just like in your book, in your chapter where you were literally at a life or death situation and you asked God to help you, and he did. I feel very strongly in my faith, and it's complicated. In fact, I probably should write a book about this someday, but my dad was a minister, and he had his own, you know, he's a human being. He was a human being who had his own demons from his own childhood, and he did the best that he could. You know, so I grew up in a church, and that's a complicated story, but I feel very blessed because I ask God every day, guide me to do your work, give me the ability to carry it out and bring people into my life who have abilities that I don't have to serve you. And, oh, I'm getting chills because he is awesome and amazing. And He saved my life. I was literally saved through a spiritual awakening when he spoke to me and told me that if I didn't stop drinking, I was going to hurt myself or someone else. And so I stopped drinking for 11 years out of fear. I didn't actually go to AA until 11 years later, but I will never forget his voice speaking to me straight to my heart that I needed to stop. And I am on a mission to serve what I believe is my purpose in life, which is to teach self-acceptance to create a greater and more joyful world.
Amen. Okay. Woo. Wow. Okay. Well, that's a powerful testimony, Susan. Powerful testimony. You've coined the term, and we've been speaking about this without hearing the term. You've coined the term adult survivors of a damaged past. How have the stresses from your childhood inspired you to serve people in their personal and work lives?
Yeah, thank you. The ASDP. So Martha and I were writing the book and we didn't really know what to call ourselves from dysfunctional childhoods. You know, there was ACOA, Adult Children of Alcoholics, but this was a much bigger state of dysfunction that we were talking about. So we created ASDP, Adult Survivor of a Damaged Past. And there's a whole definition around each one of the letters of the acronym. But that for me, the childhood experiences, and then eventually my only sister was diagnosed with Hodgkin's disease, fourth stage Hodgkin's, when she was 16. She died 10 years later. And the night of her death was a very traumatic night for a lot of reasons, which I describe in the book. It's a pretty intense story. But I remember after her death, because God was very much present in the whole experience, that I felt compelled that I had to write down the story of what happened to her the night she died. And it's a gruesome story and it's a terrible story, but I just felt like a duty was being called upon to write it down. And over time, I just started writing more stories from my past. And eventually, I won't go into all the details, but I eventually created my first manuscript. And so all of the dynamics that my sister and I experienced when we were growing up, our parents did the best they could. And I very deeply believe that. My mom's still living and is doing great. And she's amazing, an amazing mentor and hero of mine. But those childhood experiences really led me to this path of self and going on a journey of healing, which led me to organizations like Pathways to Successful Living, where I discovered my life purpose, which I just shared with you. It led me to going to the Healing Trauma Program at OnSite, which was an amazing 7 days of intense work to release the pain of the past. And through all of those experiences, whether it was attending Adult Children of Alcoholics, seeing a therapist, doing these different things to try to find my own healing, it became the evolution was the creation of Healing at Work with Martha. And I already told you that I feel like my mission is to teach self-acceptance to create a more joyful world. And so that's really, from the stories of the past all the way to the present, that's the gift that the pain has created.
How can audience members purchase your book?
Yeah, it's easy. Amazon. I will tell you, on the cover of the book are two bumper cars facing off, because Martha and I call workplace conflict bumper car moments. And if you go into Amazon, Susan, either Susan Winchester, healingatwork.com, or Susan Schmidt, S-C-H-M-I-T-T, Winchester, because I've got Schmidt in my published author name. But it's super easy. And we also have available on Audible, too.
Susan, how can leaders around the world reach out to you for your consulting services?
Easy. It's SusanWinchester.com, https://SusanWinchester.com. You'll see all things about my consulting, my executive coaching, my keynote speaking. And I would love to share more of this work with organizations that are passionate about leadership capability and culture.
Susan, what excites you about the future?
I would say what excites me about my future came from work with my personal coach, Celine DaCosta, a year ago, where I spent 2 days with her. And I'm going back to spend 2 days with her in Austin, Texas, coming up in 2 weeks, where the whole focus was, how do I design my life by soul? And how do I design my business by soul? And so I'm very excited about and loving my work working with leaders and their teams to do great work that not only is great in terms of its impact on people, but it's great for performance also. So very excited about the work that we're doing and the continued journey to teach self-acceptance to create a more joyful world.
Wow. A more joyful world. Look at, we need that. We need that in these times and days. Susan, how do you want to be remembered?
Well, you know, I think it's very much what we've already talked about. I hope to be remembered as somebody who is on a mission to serve others and having more joyful lives. And I love coming into organizations, for-profit, not-for-profit, universities, corporate, whatever, and sharing the message of when your past gets in the way of your future and what to do about it. Because when people start to become aware, they become awake to the influences of their past on their present experiences, they then can begin to live a completely different life. They are different as leaders and employees in their workplaces, and they can also start to shape their own families outside of work as well. So that's what I hope to be remembered by, is for bringing meaningful work to the world that helps people have better lives.
Okay, well, I want that to just to settle in. That's heavy. We have a servant leader. We have a rainmaker. We have someone that's influencing leaders around the world, from tech to academia and beyond. Susan Winchester, thank you for joining us here at the Undisputed Podcast. Team members and family, please go out and purchase Susan's book, Healing at Work, but also reach out to Susan about keynote speaking and consulting for your organizations, a transformative leader. And for those of you who are part of the family, listen, understand this, the Undisputed Podcast, we're bringing leaders around all industries that's driving transformation. For those of you interested to bring this podcast to your organization, reach out to my team at tyblesser.com. Susan, I definitely thank you so much. To our fam out there, stay encouraged, keep your head up and your eyes open. And until next time, take care of yourselves and take care of each other.